KALW.
Well, I'm curious if we'll see a wilderness sign. Say we're entering the designated wilderness.
Yeah, well, let's pause if we do. I love those signs.
It's like nothing says wilderness like a sign.
America's wilderness is changing, but what does wilderness even mean?
To have a place that's allowed to change and evolve and undergo its natural evolution, but that is really not what we're seeing.
We begin unpacking it all today with the new series, How Wild. Then we hear how a UC Berkeley linguist is fighting for American Spanish.
We have Spanish speakers that go into the Spanish classroom and are confronted by books and or instructors that tell them that the way that they use their native language is bad.
That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. What comes to your mind when you think of wilderness? For me, I think of open savannas with tall grass or a stand of tall, thick baobab trees. For you, it may be a bright, starry night or even a grove of mighty sequoias miles and miles away from civilization. But what does wilderness really mean, and how is it changing? Today, we begin to unpack that question with an excerpt from the first episode of a new podcast, How Wild. This series tries to answer this question as climate change, increased visitation, and new technologies are testing the definition of wilderness. Before we hit the trail, I sat down with the series producer and host, our very own Marissa Ortega Welch. Hi, Marissa.
Hi, Hannah.
So you've been at KALW since 2017. You've been our science reporter, you're an editor in our newsroom, and the host of our series Natural State that brings our listeners sound portraits of California's wildlife and landscapes. And today you're launching your own series on wilderness.
That's right. This series is the result of 3 years of reporting and traveling all across the country, and I haven't at all been stressed about the launch. I'm totally ready and totally calm.
You look calm, totally calm. But what motivated you to make this podcast?
Well, I'm a backpacker, and I spend a lot of time in wilderness, and so I was noticing a lot of changes. And this year turns out to be the 100th anniversary of the U.S.'s first designated wilderness area. Mm. So I got really interested in how our relationship has been changing as we hit this century milestone and what that means for the next 100 years of wilderness.
Okay, and very exciting. The series is also being distributed by NPR.
That's right. So we're going to be airing excerpts of it here on Cross Currents on Tuesdays, but you can find the full episodes on NPR's website, and you can subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, cannot wait. All right, let's hit the trail.
My best friend Holly and I have been hiking in the wilderness together for 20 years.
We got everything back there.
You got my pack over, you got the rainfly. Let's go.
Where's the trail?
I don't know.
Every summer, we go on a backpacking trip somewhere in the West. California's Sierra Nevada, the Olympic Mountains in Washington, the Wind River Range in Wyoming.
Look at how the rain on the willows is glistening in the sunlight, like glitter.
Ooh. This is so pretty.
I love being in wilderness. It's my happy place. Away from roads, the pressures of daily life. The only things to think about are hiking and eating.
I think you need help with those mangoes. I'll trade you for your Snickers.
And just getting to be in a beautiful place where humans and our stuff aren't the dominant features.
Oh, marmot.
Official wilderness is an area protected from development, set aside by the government to be a place where humans are just visitors. And even though I love visiting these capital W designated wilderness areas, the concept of wilderness itself has always bugged me, because it could be seen as erasing the history of indigenous peoples who were forcibly removed from the land so it could be protected. And it can create this idea that humans are separate from nature. In the last 10 years, Holly and I have noticed a lot of changes to wilderness. There was the year it was so smoky from fires, we couldn't see the mountains that were right in front of us. The year it was such a big winter, we couldn't get over mountain passes because of all the snow hanging on into the summer. The next year, there was so little snow that the creeks had dried up and we had to carry drinking water for miles. There was the time we got to a view and looking out across the forest, it seemed every third tree was brown instead of green, killed by beetles that are spreading because of drought and a lack of fire. It's not just physical changes. I've seen more people on the trail. I bring my phone now to take pictures, but also I've had cell service in some places miles from a road. Some of the changes I've seen are really good, like how the internet is helping more people learn about wilderness and get outside. But good or bad, the meaning of wilderness is changing. The definition is being tested. If it isn't a place to unplug in a land untouched by humans, and if it never was, what does that mean for these physical places we call wilderness? And what does that mean for us as humans if there's no place outside our impact, no separation between humans and this thing we call nature? I'm Marissa Ortega Welch, and this is How Wild, a podcast about wilderness, how it's changing, and what that says about us as humans. In the next 6 episodes, we're going to be hiking through wilderness areas around the West. If you've never been to wilderness, if you're not a hiker, don't worry. I'm a former wilderness guide, trained in backcountry first aid. I'm good at reading maps. If you've backpacked a lot, get ready, because we might be unpacking some of the assumptions you've brought with you. That's what I've been doing myself the last few years. So lace up your boots, bring extra water, and don't forget snacks. Because the first place we're going is on a hike that I've been warned many times is hard. This is episode 1, Untrammeled.
Where the trail ends, the official trail is down here, and then we start on these zigzags going up.
We're in California's Sequoia National Park, and we're headed off trail to a remote, rugged corner, which is kind of the whole point.
And I can actually pull out a map. So
this is the person I'm relying on not to get us lost. And then will you say your name and your title?
Yeah, this is Andrew Bishop. I'm the restoration ecologist at Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park.
I'm excited.
Okay. Yeah, same here.
And nervous.
I didn't mention rattlesnakes.
Oh.
We should be aware that in the lower elevation part of this hike, there's a good potential for a rattlesnake.
Plus, there's poison oak and these annoying flies that keep getting in our face.
The sunglasses are helping for the face flies.
Oh, good.
Just for the record.
Yeah, no,
I wouldn't be putting up with all this if I wasn't getting to see something today that not a lot of people have seen. It's 2022, and we're heading to Board Camp, the name of a grove of giant sequoias that burned 2 years before in the Castle Fire. Giant sequoias, the biggest trees on Earth, only live here in California. And nearly half are found in Sequoia Kings Canyon National Parks. But since 2020, severe fires burned up to a fifth of the world's giant sequoias. Some scientists are worried that we could face a future with no giant sequoias in Sequoia National Park. The national park wants to replant giant sequoias in the wilderness. Other people say that goes against the very definition of wilderness. The debate is really around the question, what is natural and how much should humans intervene? That's why we're here today. Almost as soon as we leave the trailhead, we're in what's called the John Krebs Wilderness.
Well, I'm curious if we'll see a wilderness sign. Say we're entering the designated wilderness?
Yeah, well, let's pause if we do. I love those signs.
Yeah, it's like nothing says wilderness like a sign.
The fact that we're in an area designated as capital W wilderness is really important. Wilderness areas are the most protected public lands in the U.S. Maybe you've been to Yosemite Valley. You drove there or took the bus to see Yosemite Falls. Maybe you've just seen pictures. It's beautiful, but the valley isn't technically wilderness. If you headed out on the trail, away from the roads, within a few miles, you'd enter into a designated wilderness zone. Starting in the 19-teens, as tourists flocked to national parks and forests, roads and buildings were built to accommodate them. environmentalists got worried that the land that was supposed to be protected was getting developed. So they came up with an idea for setting aside some areas from development, an extra level of protection, as what they called wilderness.
A wilderness is an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain.
And in 1964, the president signed into law the Wilderness Act.
An area of wilderness is further defined to mean, in this act, an area of undeveloped federal land retaining its primeval character and influence, without permanent improvements or human habitation, which is protected and managed so as to preserve its natural conditions.
This is a very happy and historic occasion for all who love the great American outdoors, and that, needless to say, includes me.
More recently, land managers broke down the Wilderness Act into five measurable qualities of wilderness character: untrammeled, undeveloped, natural, with opportunities for solitude and primitive, unconfined recreation, and other features of value. Today, wilderness managers work hard to make sure they're meeting these standards. They do surveys to make sure people are experiencing enough solitude. They only put in trail signs if absolutely necessary, so as to not take away from the primitive recreation experience. I hear land managers talk a lot about the idea of restraint. They only intervene if absolutely necessary. Generally speaking, ecologists like my guide, Andrew, can only do restoration work in wilderness if the damage they're trying to restore was directly caused by humans. So, like pulling out invasive plants introduced by pack horses, or restoring a meadow that was impacted by an old trail. Sequoia National Park is a fascinating example in a growing debate. How much should people intervene to restore wilderness? Because with climate change, every part of the planet is affected by humans, even wilderness.
We'll kind of go around the back a little bit and over a ridge that you can't quite see from here. And that's where Board Camp is.
A couple miles into our hike, Andrew and I stop to look up the steep canyon where we're headed. And we can see burned trees. I see a bunch of, I think I'm just seeing skeletons of trees up there, right?
Yeah, this fire just ripped up that. You can imagine that's where we really saw high severity fire in the Castle Fire.
The strategy for over the last 100 years has been to put out wildfires in California to protect homes and timber. Right in this valley, fire crews extinguished dozens of lightning fires over the years. But fire is important. Without it, smaller trees and shrubs grow unchecked, like matchsticks waiting to be lit. All that fuel on the ground, plus a hotter and drier climate, means California's fires now burn hotter, faster, and bigger. Like the Castle Fire, it was started by lightning in August of 2020 and burned for months.
In the moment of the fire, it's very hard to know what you're going to find afterwards.
This is Christy Brigham, Chief of Resource Management and Science at Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. As the fire kept spreading, she checked on the sequoia groves the way you might check on a loved one after an emergency.
It's smoky, you don't know what's happening. So we were getting these different reports. I was calling people who had connections and like, has anybody seen this grove or that grove?
As a biologist, Christy knows that giant sequoias need fire. The heat from the flames below triggers the cones to open and drop their seeds, and the fire clears the ground of underbrush and creates soft mineral soil, perfect growing conditions. But Christy could sense that something different might be going on here. And then she got signs confirming her fear, downwind in the town of Three Rivers.
Large chunks of sequoia needles were falling on the ground in Three Rivers. And so those were indications when the fire was burning that the fire was destroying a lot of sequoias.
She knew this meant that the fire was burning hot enough to reach the needles of the world's biggest trees. As soon as winter was over, Christy assembled a crew to hike out to the Board Camp Grove,
which was in itself a journey because none of us had been there before.
The group climbed over burned down logs and bushwhacked through chaparral to survey the fire's effects.
It was terrible. It was like the surface of the moon. There was nothing alive.
The fire had in fact reached the seed cones in the tops of the giant sequoias and killed off most trees entirely.
So at that point, we thought, we're going to have to come back out here. There may not be sequoia seedlings here because of the way the fire burned.
That's when Christy and her team started to plan. Board Camp wasn't the only sequoia grove that burned, and because most of the fire occurred in a wilderness area, the team knew they'd have to take special considerations. Now, the Wilderness Act asks land managers to not trammel the land unless absolutely necessary.
And trammel's kind of a beautiful, poetic, old-timey word, so people might not know what that means.
A trammel is a device used to shackle a horse's gait. So to be untrammeled means to be unshackled, unrestrained, free.
But what it's been generally interpreted to mean within the Wilderness Act context is that we're supposed to let nature take its course. Humans aren't supposed to hinder or interfere with natural processes.
Another one of the qualities of wilderness character is that the area is to remain natural.
To have a place that's allowed to change and evolve and undergo that its natural evolution. But that is really not what we're seeing with wildfire in California and with these impacts to these sequoia groves.
Christy and other scientists agree that even though this fire was started by a natural cause, lightning, the severity of the fire was a result of human causes.
They're driven by 100 years of fire suppression, which were poor decisions that we made as managers and made worse by climate change-driven hotter drought.
That's why scientists feel that they should try and restore the groves by replanting sequoia trees from seeds from surviving cones. Which sets up this sort of catch-22. If the burning down of these thousand-year-old fire-resilient trees wasn't natural and the park wants to restore the groves, it might need to do a little bit of trammeling.
That was an excerpt from the first episode of How Wild, a series produced by KLW's Marissa Ortega Welch with support from Cal Humanities. It's distributed as a podcast by NPR. We'll be airing excerpts on Tuesdays, and we've got a link to the full episodes at klw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. UC Berkeley sociolinguist Justin Davidson is on a mission to make American Spanish an officially recognized language. He's a professor of Hispanic linguistics at Cal, and he's studying the speaking patterns of Spanish-English bilinguals to create a linguistic map of American Spanish. Professor Davidson says there's a language discrimination that happens with American Spanish, often seen by linguists as lower quality or, quote, bad Spanish. He says languages evolve and change depending on the peoples that speak them, and that the Spanish spoken by American Hispanic communities should be seen as legitimate. I spoke with Professor Davidson to dig into what that means.
So when you think of Spanish-speaking countries, I think it's still the norm that folks are not inclined to think of the United States, which is odd because the United States is the second largest Spanish-speaking country in the world. There is more Spanish in the U.S. than every country you can possibly think of, with the exception of Mexico. And so that's connected to the fact that the kind of Spanish that we have here has, for the majority of its existence, not been treated by linguists and by speakers as legitimate, as valid.
Right. And you talk about words in American Spanish that are kind of not embraced formally, this idea of the lower class of Spanish or the lower kind of quality. And you did a series with Berkeley Voices, a podcast series. And in it, you talk about this example of troca or truck and lonche, lunch, that these are words that are common in U.S. Spanish. They clearly have influence from English. But if you write any of those words on the AP exam in Spanish, if you use those words in public, you can be told that's not the right word. You can't say it that way. Why? And why is that a problem?
Because there are groups in power that make decisions about what the correct forms are. And that's perpetuated throughout society. And in this case, through the school districts and through textbooks.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the North American Academy of Spanish that called words like troca, lonche, called them, quote, barbarisms like contamination, like pollution, that need to be excised from the language.
It won't ever work. Linguistic variation is inherent to human language. There's no way to make everyone in the world speak exactly the same way. The very existence of multiple languages is due to the fact that there's linguistic variation.
Right. It seems like it should be just a known and a given and something we're all okay with, that language is evolving always. You talk about the example of the word almohada that comes from the Arabic muhadda. And you say that nowadays, if a speaker anywhere in the world says almohada, there's no reaction of like, that's bad Spanish, don't speak Arabic. Why? What's the difference?
So sure, so Spanish has words from Arabic, Spanish has words from English, Spanish has words from other Romance languages, but their borrowing was so far back.
So you think they had their arguments a long time ago about this, just like we are now, and they've resolved it?
Speakers have always had opinions about the way they speak. In the United States, there is such a power difference between English and any other language that you could bring into this country or learn in this country. If there is any potential for the threat to English, then that's sort of a threat to the main power structure. The majority of the world's speakers are at least bilingual. Monolinguals on the planet Earth are in the minority, but it doesn't feel that way, at least in the United States.
You've been conducting these interviews with Spanish-English bilinguals in California. What makes U.S. Spanish and Californian Spanish different?
As a linguist, by and large, my main focus is not at the word vocabulary level. It's at the phonetic level. It's minute pronunciations. So we have all sorts of experiments that we routinely do.
For example, like what?
So there's an experiment that I've often run in my own research called a matched guise. So one way is get a recording of someone. And then with software, with acoustic linguistic software, manipulate the acoustics of the speech. And we play that for people. And what we ask them, it's sort of a trick. We tell them that they're about to hear clips from multiple people. Every voice they hear is a different person. But in reality, no. Two of those voices come from the same person. And what we ask them is, tell us what you think about this person. On a scale of 1 to 7, how educated do they sound?
Hoy es un día bonito.
How masculine are they?
Hoy es un día bonito.
What's this person's race? What's this person's age? We make those connections between the linguistic forms and all of the speakers that those forms remind us of, that we associate. And from those speakers, these different values. So in many Spanish-speaking communities in the world, the majority of Spanish-speaking communities in the world, cow is ba-ba-ba, even though it's written with the letter V. But in U.S. Spanish, and of course then in California Spanish, I've been tracking the use of va.
So they would say vaca as?
La vaca. Because U.S. Spanish, for the majority of its history, has not been deemed as a legitimate Spanish variety, we tend to think of, if you hear anything interesting or sort of non-standard in U.S. Spanish, you think that it's non-native speakers doing it. But no. It's not just my L1 English speakers that are doing this. It's L1 Spanish speakers.
Do you think this can happen? Can you really get to a point where American Spanish is legitimized as a language in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's minimally a two-pronged issue. So on the one hand, speakers themselves need to not feel ashamed and or embarrassed about the way that they speak. They need to have pride in the way that they speak and certainly not take in any of the vitriol and kind of language discrimination that's unfortunately out there and that probably won't go away. That second prong then is it's linguists working to remind the general population that the idea of correct and better sort of good language, that's not a linguistic question. It's not actually about language. We respond very much to the education system and what's presented to us as correct. So that second prong then is textbooks and really working with the education system. Slowly but surely, linguists are writing, are creating textbooks about U.S. Spanish. Eventually, if we could influence textbooks to be more transparent about not just linguistic diversity, but in particular about forms of U.S. Spanish, then that'll do a lot of good for unfortunately, what happens a lot of times now, which is we have Spanish speakers that go into the Spanish classroom and are confronted by books and or instructors that tell them that the way that they use their native language is bad. And that's so, I mean, that quite literally, it's linguistic discrimination, and it's based on all of these social hierarchies throughout history that don't actually relate to anything actually good or bad about language, but rather the differences between groups in power and groups that are in positions of lesser power.
Justin Davidson is professor of Hispanic linguistics at UC Berkeley, and that interview was produced by Julia Haney. Today's Cross Currents team includes Arun Nair, Zen Iqbal, Hussein Khan, James Rowlands, Ganadijo Johnson, Victor Tense, Shireen Adil, Angela Johnston, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Dawood Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.